This is Phil Davidson, and with me today is Rockford Symphony Orchestra Music Director Stephen Larson. We are discussing the RSO's Classics 3 concert, Frankenstein and Mozart, on Saturday, January 18th, 7:30 p.m. at the Coronado Performing Arts Center. Well, on this program, before we enter the domain of Frankenstein, we get to experience the delightful For a Beautiful Land by Linda Robbins Coleman. Now, I believe she's a Midwesterner.
She's more than a Midwesterner. She is an Iowan.
Okay, Iowan. All right.
And that's very, very important to her identity.
Okay. Then she's from Iowa. And it's my understanding she simply began writing music without really having a formal composition teacher. Can you tell us more about her?
Well, yeah. Well, she's a pianist. She majored in music education at Drake. And while she was there, she began composing. She just wanted to write music and had never taken a composition lesson. Now, that might seem a little strange, but it really isn't. A composition teacher is certainly not necessary. If you have the urge to write music, you know how to read and write music, you can certainly do it. The main thing a composition teacher will do to you is help you to focus ideas and perhaps improve some technical aspects and deal with form a little bit better. But you certainly don't need a teacher to get started. It's not like learning to play the violin and just being self-taught, and that's a little bit more of a problem. Composing, once you're a musician, anybody who feels the urge can write some music.
For a Beautiful Land is described as a symphonic poem. So can you describe for us what a symphonic poem is and maybe how it's different from a symphony?
Sure. Symphonic poems date back to the mid-19th century when some composers began to experiment with the idea of telling a story through music or representing poetry or a visual, something, a scene, a city, a picture, or something like that, through music. And Franz Liszt was really the first person to do this, although Hector Berlioz kind of got into that a little bit in his Symphonie Fantastique. And you can use various different techniques to portray a place or an idea. You can use folk music, you can use the idea in this particular case, she uses some bird song or imitations of bird song to imitate nature. But in the case of For a Beautiful Land, if you didn't know anything about the title and just listened to it from beginning to end, I think that you would have a very positive view of what you just heard. It would be pleasant. You would like it. You might not think it had anything to do with Iowa or A Beautiful Land or anything else. You could probably title it something else. But for her, she said that in her writings about this piece that she had particular places in mind when she wrote this, but she prefers to keep them to herself. So it's you can imagine that somebody writing about a place that they're calling a beautiful land is going to write a piece that's going to have a sort of an uplifting, mm-hmm. positive feeling, and this certainly does. As far as anything more specific than that, well, the listener is free to infer anything you want to in terms of what you're listening to. In this particular case, Iowa, her native state. But symphonic poems run the gamut. Again, it can be a poem that is being illustrated. It can be a story. It can be a traditional tale. It can be just a visual. Some years ago, we did a national park suite where each movement was supposedly depicted a particular national park. And again, there is a limited power of music to specifically evoke time and place. When music does that, it usually has to get very specific and either do some onomatopoeic things, do sound effects or particular folk songs or traditional melodies, or in this case, birds.
All right. Well, now that we are, at peace with this beautiful land, let's move on to H.K. Gruber's Frankenstein. And I said it real loud because it's got two exclamation marks.
Yeah, it needs a two exclamation. Not just one exclamation point, but two.
Yeah, it's got two. And then the rest of it is, and there's a hyphen between these two words, a pandemonium for chansonnier, I got close, and ensemble.
There's a lot of things to think about here.
Yeah, there sure are. He's a contemporary composer. I believe he's still with us.
Yes. Born in 42, I believe. He's 70.
Oh, okay. Could you give us some background on him and also his involvement in, I believe, what were called salon concerts?
Yeah. This is a fascinating guy. He's not terribly well known over here. And when he is well known, it's usually for this piece, which has gotten a fair amount of play. Premiered, I think, in 1996, and has kind of put him on the map musically. If the name Gruber is a least bit familiar to you, you might recall that Franz Gruber wrote
yes.
Silent Night.
Yes.
And H.K. Heinz Karl Gruber is the great-great-grandson of Franz Gruber.
All right.
Now, that's a little bit of trivia. Heinz Karl Gruber, though, grew up in Vienna. He was one of the Vienna Choir Boys, a very famous mm-hmm. choral singing ensemble. Went to the Vienna Hochschule for Music and became a double bass player and composer. Began writing music that he called salon music. Now, salon music, it's do you play it in the salon? Well, okay, what's a salon these days? A salon used to be a name for a living room or sort of mm-hmm. what we call a living room. But salon music, the tradition goes back all the way to the early 20th century, really into the 19th century, of music played in private residences for friends who perhaps either played the instruments themselves or had other people come in and play the instruments. And they would discuss the music and perhaps they would discuss the literature that inspired the music. A very, very artsy affair in a lot of ways, and something that over the years has died out, but people have tried to revive along the way. Salon music in this particular case was, in Gruber's case, came up in the city of Darmstadt, around there. Darmstadt, in the middle of the 20th century, was a real hotbed of really contemporary avant-garde music. In Germany, that's where it was all centered. And this is really far out experimental stuff. And salon music was a reaction to that. Let's not do the experimental stuff. Let's not do 12-tone music. Let's do something that is a little bit easier to listen to and perhaps and we'll nourish the soul a little bit, not just the intellect. So Gruber wrote a lot of pieces that he considered to be salon music, smaller ensembles usually. And this piece is an outgrowth of one of those. He started with writing about some of the poems by a German absurdist poet named H.C. Artmann, who wrote some nonsense poems, some macabre children's poems, which are included here. And Gruber, who appears to have a really highly developed sense of humor, decided to make design a piece of music around these poems. Now, this is the only piece I can think of that calls for a chansonnier with orchestra. That's not a term we use in English. It's French, of course. A chansonnier is a male performer. A chansonnière would be a female performer. And this is a person who sings, who speaks, who recites, who Edith Piaf is if you know her work, is a little bit in that particular vein, bridging the gap between speaking and singing. So some of these pieces are sung, some of these are spoken, some of these are kind of a mixture in between between the two. And there is a recording in English, as well as in German, with the composer himself reciting the poems. The English translations are really excellent. It's not always easy to translate German and to match up the rhythms with an English translation that make things intelligible, but remarkably, these are.
Well, just looking at the title of this piece, I have a lot of questions. But in the interest of time, can you give us some kind of idea, something, what is behind this title with the two marks? And
I think the two exclamation marks are first of all, designed to get your attention. We all know Frankenstein, and when you say Frankenstein, probably the first thing that comes to your mind is Boris Karloff.
Absolutely.
The iconic original first movie Frankenstein. The English majors might disagree and say, well, it's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and it's really, you know, Frankenstein's really not the monster. You know, Frankenstein was his inventor. Creator, but in most people's mind, Frankenstein is the Frankenstein monster. But I think that the two exclamation points are to disabuse you of the idea that this is anything about the monster. The subtitle, a pandemonium with the hyphen in there. Of course, pandemonium is general uproar and excitement. With the hyphen in there, you look at the pandemonium and the demon part of it. And of course, this is nothing sinister at all. It's very, very tongue-in-cheek. I like to think of this, the macabre poems, a little bit like the Addams Family. They're Ooky and gooky and altogether spooky or whatever it is, the Addams Family. The first poem, little mouse, takes me to his mousy house. Now he nibbles out my eye, lost without my eyes. I will bake a currant pie with raisins sweet, take two out but not to eat. You think, where is this going? Well, you put the two raisins in to in place of the eyes, to replace the eyes, and sunshine. It's silly. It's the idea of a mouse nibbling out your eyes, of course, a horrible thing. But in the context of baking the raisin pie and replacing it with the raisins out, and everything's fine after that. Well, it's silly. I think of R.L. Stine's Goosebumps for Children. There's a lot. Well, Where the Wild Things Are, wildly popular book for children, featuring very prominently a bunch of monsters, and they're very ferocious monsters who end up pleading with Max not to go home. Please stay, and play with them. These the poems run a wide gamut from the eponymous Frankenstein. He's referred to a couple of times during the piece. Various comic book characters. John Wayne has his own particular movement.
Yes, I read those poems and I'm thinking, wow, this is all over the place, but very interesting.
And they you sometimes, like a lot of perhaps a surrealist, surreal I think is a good way to describe these poems. If you are familiar with the artwork of Salvador Dali, and the flaming giraffes and the melting stopwatches and things like their pocket watches, there's a lot of that flavor in here, of things that you start hearing about something and you think you might know where it's going, and then it goes something very, very strange, someplace very strange. And by the time you get to the end of it, you think, wait a minute, how did we get here? So it's a lot of fun. For a fairly small orchestra, but extremely diverse sounds coming out of this orchestra.
Well, I understand there may be some toy instruments involved.
There are a lot of toy instruments because everybody except the string players are required to play at least one toy instrument. And they range from melodicas, those little keyboard things that you blow into, to pieces of tubing that you whirl around your head and they produce a musical sound, to kazoos, to a toy piano. One point, balloons are blown up and popped in the orchestra, as are paper bags. I think the whole thing, the whole purpose is to... It's very visual, too, because you see all this stuff happening. You see the people playing these instruments, and it's to give you this sense of, where am I? what's going on here? This is an orchestra, isn't it? Why are those people playing kazoos and melodicas and things like that and whirling tubes around their heads? And it's absurd. It's fun. More than anything else, it's a lot of fun. And you hear some of the poems, you think, oh, that's creepy. But it's delivered in such a way that you can't help but smile.
Hmm. Great. Sounds like a barrel of fun. Well, then following that, we calm down a little bit.
Intermission. You know, lets us do that, yes.
The program finishes with Mozart's Symphony No. 39. And I think this is one of his last three symphonies. And I think those, if I understand, those three symphonies were written in a six-week period.
Yeah. Very,
wow.
very wrote these. And the connection here between Gruber and Mozart, well, they're both, I think they're both from Vienna, or at least have their careers in Vienna. One little bit of coincidence I did discover is that Franz Gruber wrote Silent Night in a village church that about 11 miles from where Mozart was born. So there's, I don't know what that means, but there's some some connection there. Anyway, yeah, these, the last three symphonies of Mozart, 39, 40, and 41, these are sort of holy works in a way in the classical music world, because they're considered to be his greatest symphonies, all three of them. It's kind of hard to pick them out. You can say that I have a favorite, but you can't really say that one is greater than the other. And they're so different. They're so different. The middle one, the G minor symphony, the so-called tragic, it stands out so vividly from any of his other pieces. But they have in common a couple of things. First of all, this is probably the worst period of Mozart's life. In financially, personally, he was in very, very bad psychological condition and monetary condition during this period. He was desperately begging his friends for financial help. His career was going nowhere. As a matter of fact, it seemed to be collapsing. Just a couple years before, he was the toast of Vienna. And now people just weren't interested in his music anymore. And he was having trouble of just getting people to commission operas or perform operas that he wrote, which is his big money maker. He generally wrote symphonies for concerts that he put on for himself, you know, that sold subscriptions to, and he would play piano concertos and do a symphony that he had composed. But now he writes these three symphonies, and they are so unlike Mozart in some way, because Mozart almost never wrote anything that he didn't have a specific purpose for, that he wasn't going to make money from. You know, he was a composer, and he composed to live, to make money. You know, carpenters don't go out and build houses in their spare time just because they like doing carpentry. And Mozart didn't write music in his spare time unless he thought he was going to make money. Mm-hmm. But there's no evidence that any of these three symphonies were ever performed in his lifetime, or very little evidence anyway. Little scraps and, you know, little hints there and there. Maybe, possibly, there's a couple of little hints writing about, well, you know, we heard a new Mozart symphony this weekend. But where? How? Who? What? We don't know. So he wrote these three very, very different pieces in the course of 6 weeks, and they turned out to be, well, you know, the apex of symphonic repertoire at the time. 39 has always actually been one of my favorites. It's different from the others. It sort of tells you from the beginning it doesn't take itself too seriously, and it's very, I think if you would probably listen to it and say, this is somebody who is very happy, very carefree, and loving life. Well, you know, keep in mind, this was not a very happy time in his life, but this is just something that a lot of composers did this. They wrote happy music when they were in bad shape, and they wrote tragic music when they were happy, and balancing things out. This particular piece is a little unusual in that it doesn't use oboes in the woodwind section. Now, you might think today, well, a symphony, a wind section, has flutes and oboes and clarinets and bassoons. Yes, that's pretty standard today, but in the 19th century, the this was still at a period that things were becoming standardized, and clarinets were a fairly new instrument at the time. I mean, they'd been around since the early 18th century, the early 19th century, but really hadn't become part of the orchestra until much, much later. Well, now Mozart makes a very conscious decision to take out the oboes, which were really the first woodwind instruments mm-hmm. to be in the orchestra, take out the oboes completely and replace them with clarinets. And why? Well, oboes have a very piercing sound, very almost a nasal but very bright sound, and clarinets have a very a dark, more rounded sound. So you have to see, he was thinking of something particular for this piece. He wanted a particular sound, a more mellow sound coming out of the orchestra. And the key goes very, very well with that. E flat major is a great clarinet key. They play very easily in that key, and they sound very good there. So this piece has no oboes. Everything else is pretty much as you might expect in a 19th century symphony, four movements. But he doesn't break any grounds here. He just writes great music. No, he's not trying to prove anything. You get to the G minor symphony, that symphony number 40, symphony number 41, and he's pulling out some new tricks in these pieces. Not to say that there's nothing new in 39, but there's nothing as innovative as what he does in 40 and 41. It's just kind of a listener's piece. You listen to it, you enjoy it, and you walk away smiling.
Well, you know, there's one thing we probably should mention again, and that's sound bites, because you do have someone else involved in with the symphony during Frankenstein, and that's a local gentleman, Charles Rasmussen.
Yes.
And so let's go over sound bites again and remind people about that.
Sound bites is on Friday, the day before the classics concerts. It's at noon at Monatisi Country Club. You show up, you order lunch there off of their menu, and while you eat, I talk to whoever a soloist happens to be. We just talk about what it's like to be an artist. And this isn't program notes. We're not doing a lecture on the concert. We talk about what it is to be an artist. In this case, Charlie is a musical theater actor. I met him for the first time last year when we did Candide at Rockford University. Rockford Symphony played in the pit, and the students were on stage. He was actually a hired actor to play the part of Voltaire. I was really impressed with him, and I thought, I keep thinking, you know, he'd really be great in Frankenstein. I've done this piece before. So I asked him to do it, and he said, sure. I don't know if he knew what he was getting himself into. But so we're going to have a chance to just talk about what the learning process was, how he felt about this piece, and a little bit about his life and as an actor, as a singer, what he does.
Tremendous. Well, I mean, this program on January 18th is going to have, I suppose this is an understatement, a lot of variety.
Oh, yes.
And I mean, you have For a Beautiful Land, and then you have Frankenstein. I have to always do that because it's, you know, to Mozart. So it's a wonderful variety of great music. And just a reminder, it's happening at the Coronado Performing Arts Center, and it's on Saturday, January 18th at 7:30 p.m. And this is the Rockford Symphony Orchestra's Classics 3 concert. And if you want to find out more information about this concert or sound bites or other upcoming concerts or other things, go to rockfordsymphony.com, or you can call them at 815-965-0049. This is Phil Davidson.
And this is Steve Larson.
Thank you for listening.